Hola mi gente, my name is Jessica Yáñez and I want you to join me for some Wine and Chisme. The Wine and Chisme podcast was created to amplify voices across communities of color, all while drinking a glass of wine. From wine talk, interviews, and recaps of all things pop culture, join me every Wednesday for the Chisme. Please make sure to check out the Wine and Chisme podcast and other amazing podcasts as part of the Latina Podcasters Network.
Hola, aquí, mi gente. It's your girl, Odalis Jasmine, and y'all are listening to Hella Latino, where we talk about all things first gen, where we celebrate Latinidad, and where we highlight community excellence, because we got lots and lots of that. I don't want to talk too much in this intro because I'm just so excited for y'all to listen to this conversation with Maria, who's a friend of mine. We met at LinkedIn. She's a super powerhouse woman, una mujerón completa, who has years and years of tech experience, but not just that, she's given back to the community, to our community, through education, higher education, through nonprofits, through so much of what she does. And now she is pivoting in her career, and we're going to talk all about these first gen superpower moves that she's made in her career. So let's get straight into it. Que lo disfruten. Maria, I have been so, what's the right word? Excited feels like it's not the right word to encapsulate how I've been looking forward to this. I want the world to know who's listening that Maria is just one of those spirits that I feel like everyone needs in their life. Every human needs to feel a Maria in their life. Someone that is so gentle yet strong. Someone who is so spiritual and grounded, and you're just like beauty in a human. And I just am so excited, I guess is the only word I can come up with right now. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. So gracias. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for your beautiful words, Odalis. I am also incredibly excited and honored to be here. And you know what? As a woman of faith, I can honestly say, like, one of the biggest blessings from LinkedIn was the people that I got to work with, including you. I know that you're here to share light on the world, to bring your energy and your beauty, to be the channel that brings other people into our lives. I love listening to your podcast, and I am honored and humbled and excited to represent and to share my story, and I hope that it lands with the people who need to hear the message that you are enough and that you are here to bring light into the world. And so don't dim that light. Bring it on. Make it shine.
So Maria and I, backstory, we met through LinkedIn, and I'm not sure we met through because I think it was, oh my God, who was it? Someone invited me to do an event, and you were there, and I think that's how we officially met. And I was like, who is this Maria woman? She is just so sweet and also a badass, because the way you were so organized throughout that whole process was like, she knows what she's doing. She's a boss. And then we met in person, and I just remember we instantly just connected, and we've had so many conversations about Latinaness, womanhood in the workplace, and then we connected on other things, spirituality, what's next, future, navigating spaces as a woman, as a Latina woman. Yeah. And we've never sat down like this one-on-one to talk about Latinidad and how do you identify and go deeper into your story. So I'm very intrigued and interested and curious to see what stories we share today. So I want to start with the first question, Maria, which is a question I start every single episode with, as you know. How do you identify and why?
I definitely identify as a Latina. I am very respectful of people who identify as Latine or Latinx or Hispano or Colombiano or whatever label feels like it fits you right. But as somebody who was born in Venezuela and moved to the U.S., I was very aware of the fact that we were Venezuelan. This Latino didn't really exist back then in the 1970s. And Hispanic was a term that at the time I thought it meant Puerto Ricans and Dominicans. And I didn't think that it included me. And I didn't understand the label Hispanic until I was 18. And the registrar at college, back then people didn't have, cell phones didn't exist yet. And the registrar heard me speaking in Spanish to my dad from her phone, I'm on the phone with my dad. And she says, why do you speak Spanish? And I said, oh, my family's from Venezuela. And she said, oh, you need to check this box that says Hispanic. And I said, oh, I'm not Puerto Rican. We're not Puerto Rican. We're not Dominican. And she said, well, that's not what that means, sweetie. It just means that you're coming from a Spanish-speaking household. And I was so ecstatic. She had just shattered this limiting belief that I couldn't be part of this amazing group of people. People with whom I had so much more in common. People who could see this other part of me. And so I continue to feel that my Venezuelan self and my American self can converge under that umbrella called Latina for me.
That is beautiful. What made you think that you were excluded from Hispanic?
Well, my parents were immigrants. We came here when I was about 4 or 5 years old. My parents were diplomats, so a very different route than most people. So we were guests in this country representing our country. And we knew that we had a limited time here as guests. And my parents always ingrained it in us that we are here as guests. We represent our country. You better represent. Like, there is no jaywalking in our house. There is no gum chewing while we're on the street. Like, literally on your best behavior at all times. And we didn't understand the concept, right? Because Hispanic is a term that was coined by the U.S. Census Survey to identify Spanish-speaking households from Spain and Spanish-speaking Latin America. It's not something that we use in Latin America or Spain. In Venezuela, I don't identify as Hispanic or Latina. I identify as Caraqueña because I'm from Caracas. Right? And if I'm speaking to a fellow Latin American, most of the time they can peg me as Venezuelan. But sometimes they'll say, oh, are you Colombian? I'm like, no, I'm Venezuelan. So we, within ourselves, we don't identify as Latinos or Hispanic. Yeah. This is something that we identify with people who are not from this group. And so in New York at the time, the larger groups of Latinos were Hispanics and Dominicans. Of Hispanics were Puerto Ricans and Dominicans. And so that wasn't our group, but you better believe we were eating at their buffet on the Sunday, right? After church, we would go to buffet. Get this, all you can eat buffet at El Palacio Imperial on Jackson Avenue in New York, in Queens, $9.99 per person. Free for children under 12. I don't know how they made any money. And guess who the music background was? Tito Puente, Celia Cruz. These are the people I grew up with. So like, I knew that we liked the same food, that we enjoyed. We might call it something different. It's the same food. It's the same music. It's the same culture. But we didn't fall under that, the understanding of what Hispanic meant. And not until 14 years later, when I was 18, and the registrar tells me this, and I finally feel like my tribe, I belong. That feeling of finally belonging, right, was so strong after so many years of ni de aquí, ni de allá. Yeah. Not fitting in here, not fitting in there. I could chameleon, right, because I'm very white presenting, and I sound white, and I spent many years whitewashing my resume, my background, my name, so that I could pass, but never assimilating. We always wanted to adapt because we were guests here. And then when things changed in Venezuela, we managed to come back and become immigrants and stay because we had had that experience. But I've always had that sense of I can chameleon and show part of me here and chameleon and show part of me here and pass to a certain point. And then if I'm in corporate, all of a sudden people will say something like, oh, wow, that lipstick is really red. And I know that I've accidentally signaled that I'm not like them because they don't wear red lipstick or some mm-hmm. other signal. Right? Or the same thing in Venezuela. ¿Vas a salir así con esos zapatos de tenis? Al Walmart.
Yeah.
But I've come to terms with it. Like, I am not from there. I'm not from here. I'm from both places. And how I define my Latinidad, my Venezuelan-ness, my American-ness, is not exactly the same as my sister who shared a room with me growing up. Why would it be exactly the same as anyone else? But it also doesn't make it less valid than anyone else's. And so I want to encourage people to find those pieces of your identity that serve you and let go of the ones that don't. And not feel like that doesn't make you less Latino. You don't have to speak Spanish to be Latino or Hispanic. Speaking Spanish doesn't mean that your heart is Latino, and it's okay.
You know, there's the book called Las Venas Abiertas de Latinoamérica, right? And there's an English and Spanish version, and it goes deep into our history. I don't know if you've ever read it or if you've seen it, but it's a really dense book, and it goes deep into colonialism, our history, complicated, really, really complicated history. And one of the things that always stood out from that book was one of the first lines in the book was, se creó un mundo in the United States, right? Like there was a whole country built and they took this concept of being American, but little do they know is that all of Latin America is also American.
Yes.
We're all part of the Americas. We all are American. And when I think about that line, I think about kind of what you're talking about now is that you come here and then you feel like you're different. Oh, I'm not Dominican. I'm not Puerto Rican. I'm not the majority of what's around me. But then you get this like almost validation that you are part of their community in a different way. You may not be Dominican, Puerto Rican, but there is a shared experience of being mm-hmm. Latino, Hispanic in a country that you don't necessarily come from. It's not your motherland, right? It's not your culture, but you're here and there's a connected shared experience of being here and navigating this system. And that's what you're describing as this pan Latino experience is, you know what? Like I like arepas too. And that's not from Honduras, but we eat it. I love sancocho. That's not Honduran, but I enjoy the food. But you know, there's this pan Latino experience of like, we all have this shared language that we may not necessarily speak out loud, but it's in the food, it's in the music, it's in the way that we bring community together, nuestra calidad humana. You know, like there's so much that brings us together. And I think that's what you're talking about. And that's what I remember from that book of like, we are all still connected. We're all Americans.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And when, you know, when there's a song when I was a teenager in the 80s, and at one point it goes, Latinoamericano, presente, presente. That's the label that we use amongst ourselves, right? In Latin America, right? And then we can self-identify Venezolano, Colombiano, Hondureño, etc. But I grew up in an era where most of the books in Spanish were translated in Mexico or Spain. Most of the TV shows were translated in Mexico, right? And most Spanish-speaking media, movies, etc., was coming out of Mexico. So I grew up with a huge Mexican influence, even though I lived in Venezuela. So like Sundays, when we would go visit my grandmother, Sundays in Venezuela, I was watching películas de María Félix.
Yeah.
Right? So like this is part of our shared cultural heritage. Like in that sense, for my era, Mexico was like the United States of Latin America, where there was this very strong machine of culture that was coming out of Mexico past the golden era of movies, where they were producing and creating media. And the rest of the countries, like, we've caught up, right? Like, now there's a level of parody. There's TV shows coming from everywhere. And there's translations happening in the moment, thanks to AI. But for those of us that are from an older generation, now I'm pretty open about it, and I'm 53. I grew up tasting Mexico. I grew up tasting Colombia, because there were so many immigrants in Venezuela from a lot of different countries. So this was part of my shared experience. And in New York, in my American side, it was also like there weren't Venezuelan restaurants. Venezuelans were a very small immigrant population in the U.S., like completely insignificant relative to other groups. So if we wanted to have arepas and tostones and plátanos, we had to go to a restaurant that had that, or go to a store that had it. And it was going to be probably a Colombian store or a Puerto Rican store. And so you learn to use different words that are used in those cultures, and you learn to realize they call it something else, but a rose by any other name, right? And you see it, like, before they leave the house, they say, bendición, mami. Or they come to the house and they say, bendición, right? It's like there's a lot of shared culture. Are we all exactly the same? No. But we have a lot in common. And I think these shared experiences give us a sense of, have given me a sense of hermandad, of sisterhood and brotherhood with people from other countries, especially if, like me, they're immigrants now in the U.S. Like, I've made my life here, and I haven't even been back to Venezuela in 16 years. Like, I'm not sure I would recognize what's happening there.
Well, tell me about the immigration story. Do you remember, because you said you came as diplomats, you were here when you were 4 years old, and then you came as an immigrant. Was there like a back and forth between the U.S. and Venezuela? Like, tell me about that time throughout your life where you were kind of understanding, like, de aquí y de allá, ni de aquí ni de allá. Like, you were just kind of in between these two worlds.
Yeah, I didn't have the words for it, but I went back. We went back, and I was probably like 7 years old. And there's something called counterculture shock. So when you go somewhere, you have culture shock seeing different things, right? So Americans go to Scandinavia, and they're shocked that moms leave babies outside the store in a stroller sleeping while mom's inside shopping or eating, right? That's shocking to us. If you leave your baby outside in America, somebody's going to steal it, or the cops are going to come and get you. So that's culture shock. Counterculture shock is when you go back to your home country after living somewhere, whether you were an exchange student or an immigrant, and you no longer accept certain things that were natural to your culture. So for me, I didn't have these words, right, as a young child, but there were things that I recognized that I didn't like, that rubbed me wrong, and I didn't have the language for it. And then when we moved back to the U.S., I turned 9. So it was like back and forth. So 9 until 14, I lived in the U.S. And I went back just in time for my quinceañera. And when you go back and you're living in another country, vacation is amazing. Everybody comes out to play, and it's all holiday, all day, 24/7. But when you live there, it's the reality of no hay agua, se fue la luz, right? Like the water isn't running this week, or there's no electricity, or, you know, the little things that would rub me the wrong way. Like, my brother could go out, but I couldn't because I was a girl. I wasn't allowed to wear shorts. Didn't matter how hot it was. It was just indecente. It's like 100 degrees, people. I'm not trying to be indecent. I'm trying to cool off.
Right.
And so these cultural, unwritten cultural norms would really, really rub me the wrong way. And I didn't have the language to express it. And the expectation was that I was Venezuelan, I should behave like a Venezuelan. But I had just spent the last 5 years adapting to being an American child in New York City, right? So you go back, you have this counterculture shock. And once I finished high school and I completed a year of college, I decided I wanted to come back to the States. Came back to Fordham University. My dream was Georgetown, but my parents felt that it wasn't proper for a girl to be living in a dorm room without adults. So although I got in, they said, you need to go to a Catholic university near home. And Fordham University fit the bill. And so I went there. And it was, you know, again, the culture shock. But now this time, I had a little bit more understanding. And I could find the people with whom I identified more closely. And guess what they were? Colombianos, Mexicanos, Cubanos. I found the Latino crew, who didn't self-identify as Hispanic or Latino, but we knew we were birds of a feather. Yeah.
I just have so many questions about that time of your life. Like, now you're in school. Was it easy to find that community, or did you, like, was there another type of culture shock of like, okay, now I'm in an education system. Like, I'm just imagining you navigating these waters that are so different, right? And also navigating two countries and cultures.
Yeah, I was very lucky that when I went back to Venezuela in grade school, I was in an American school. So it was the same school system, although it was bilingual. And when I came back to the U.S., I went to private school my whole life. And so I was used to having a very high academic rigor, and I like learning. I like studying. I have a lot of intellectual curiosity about how things work and words. I love words and I don't love math. And so I had my work cut out for me going back and forth and learning to prioritize the things I didn't like math, because I needed to pass the class and I didn't always understand what the teacher was saying, right? Because just because you speak the spoken language doesn't mean you are at par with your fellow seventh graders or 10th graders or whatever grade you're in. And so there was always a steep learning curve in the beginning, like a hockey stick learning curve, to get to the academic level. And then the different learning styles in Latin America, it's very much about memorization and regurgitation of data. So I had to adjust my learning style to that. But because I liked learning, I had a successful career, right? I got good grades and I was able to do well. And I identified as a student, as a good student. But I had the privilege of having access to resources and to everything that I needed to be a successful student, right? I didn't have to work. And I didn't have to worry about whether there was food or water. As my father would always tell me, you've never been hungry, Maria. You don't know what it's like not to have shoes. And he grew up very, very humble, didn't even own a pair of shoes until he was 15. In fact, when he was gifted the shoes, he walked home barefoot because he didn't want his shoes to get scuffed.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, before that, he wore alpargatas, which are like, you know, today's equivalent would be flip-flops, right? But it's like the native-made, you know, leather sole with like a fabric top. But he went from a very humble family on an island off the coast of Venezuela. At 15, he gets his first pair of shoes, a gift from his godfather, who was an engineer who studied at MIT. And fast forward to when he's 50 and he's CEO of the Venezuelan Petroleum Corporation. So like one of those rags to riches stories. And so my life was vastly different than his, because he had an education, because he had been very successful. I could have whatever I wanted or needed and whatever color I wanted or needed. That was material. But they didn't comprehend the challenges of going from one culture to the other and back and forth, because they always continued to identify as Venezuelan. They didn't identify as Hispanic or Latino. They weren't trying to adapt or assimilate. they were trying to represent, and then they were going home. But we were being asked to adapt and do well in school and represent, right? So all these other layers of expectations without the psychological understanding of the challenge and the trauma that can arise from feeling like you don't belong. Like, they knew they didn't belong, and they were fine and dandy with that because they were guests and they were going home.
Yeah. And they're at a different place in their life. They're older. Yes. They have each other. They don't have to assume, like, they found success in their own way. Now you are growing up in this environment, and you have to figure out a way to have both. To have both, like, being Venezuelan at home and knowing where you come from, the values, not going out, your brother can. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's all of those different cultural expectations. Like, you have to deal with that. And you also have to navigate the system where there's it's a cognitive dissonance, right? Like, you're navigating a whole different system on the other side where it's like, wait, but that's not how we do it. Oh, and that's not how they do it. And it's just like your brain is just, it's functioning in two different ways at the same time.
And in New York, the school system is telling me you can be anything you want to be as long as you work hard. And in Venezuela, you can be anything you want to be as long as it fits within the parameters of what a cisgendered woman would do. Because this is the 80s and the 90s. Like, times were different. I think we've all become more accepting and inclusive in the last 3 or 4 decades. But back then, things were very different. And so being unique, being different, wasn't seen as an advantage. It was seen as you're being difficult. And we are going to help you, por las buenas o por las malas, to adapt.
What was the expectation put on you, Maria, and what did you do with it?
So the expectation from my parents was always that I would get an education and then I would form a home, like get married and have children, in that order. Unfortunately, I did a study abroad when I was 18 and I went to France and fell in love with my roommate's brother. And my roommate was from Iceland. So at the ripe old age of 18, I got married and moved to Iceland. I am the first person born in Venezuela to move to Iceland in all of mankind's history. They have recorded history all the way back to 976. No other Venezuelans were there but me. I was the first one. Now there's more. He was in medical school. And so I transferred to the University of Iceland, and I needed to learn the language. So I studied Icelandic and minored in Italian. And when I transferred, I was already a junior because I was a good student. I really liked to take on a heavy load. So at 18, I was already a junior in school. So back to square one, now I'm an immigrant again. Now I'm relearning the rules. But when you're a child, there's a little bit of buffer of when you do something wrong. Other kids will correct you and explain the unwritten norms, like you can't do that. Or your tia or some adult will explain it to you. When you're a young adult, that really isn't one of the benefits that you get. And so you're this immigrant that's doing things that are wrong. That might have been right back where you were from, but they're not accepted here, right? So like Venezuela, red lights are a suggestion. Not so much in America. Definitely not in Europe or Scandinavia.
You said it's a suggestion.
Yeah, it's a decoration almost in a lot of our countries. If it's dark or late at night, it's, you know, not recommended that you pay attention to that suggestion, right? Like, you don't really stop at a red light if you care for your life. So when I moved to Iceland, it was back to square one. So now I'm an immigrant again. I've had the culture shock and counterculture shock. So now I understand what I'm going through, and I understand that the people around me, in New York or in America, in the U.S. and in Venezuela, I could pass for either. I could chameleon because I'm white presenting. But in Scandinavia, I'm not white presenting at all. They knew that I was imported. I didn't have to open my mouth to have it known. So to them, there's white and there's not white. And I was not white. Anything that's south of, like, Italy is not white. Doesn't matter what your skin color kind of looks like. And my skin color to them isn't white, period. And my hair is dark and curly. It's not blonde or light, and my eyes are dark. So I experienced for the first time in my life blatant racism. People telling me that me and my half-breed children were polluting their blood pool, their genetic pool, and that I could come back, go back where I came from. And at 20, 21, 22, 25, these are hard words to hear, but I had had the experience of moving to different places and knowing that's not true. That's what they think, and I don't have to internalize this. Now, if you're a kid growing up somewhere and hearing this, you internalize it. And that's why I opened our conversation by saying, you get to decide your identity and select what works for you, not those around you. Whether those people are people around you that love you, like your parents, telling you that girls don't wear shorts, or if it's your colleagues at LinkedIn telling you that that red sweater and that red lipstick is really red. Right? Signaling that you're stepping outside the lines. So I want, for those of us that have these multicultural identities and that are trying to figure out, well, what am I? Who am I? I want you to hear this. You get to choose the values from these different cultures that work for you. And when they no longer work for you, when they no longer serve you, it's perfectly all right to let them go and move on to a different value. Our parents, our ancestors, made huge sacrifices for our lives to be this blessed. I recognize that I've never been hungry. I've had shoes in every color my whole life, right? That doesn't
and you
mean
want I it in red.
Yeah. It doesn't mean I haven't had sacrifices that I've had to make or difficult moments, but not as difficult as my ancestors had. They worked hard to give me the blessings that I have in this life. And so rather than feeling guilty or ignoring or dismissive, I wear that crown with pride, right? Ooh. My grandmother was an entrepreneur. I learned from her. Do I live my life exactly like her? No. But I've taken values from that relationship and that relationship and that experience and that culture that I carry with me. Not all of them, the ones that serve me today. And the same thing from my time in Iceland. I had a beautiful family there, a lot of good friends. Still go back every few years to visit with my loved ones there because a little piece of me is from there too now, right? Everywhere we live for an extended period, it helps to shape who we are. But we can't, because identity and these labels are constructs created by society, we can decide how that label is defined and not accept the outside definition given to us.
I feel like the theme I'm hearing and feeling so far is this journey of belonging.
Yes.
Right, of being moving to one place, being an immigrant, and then being an immigrant times two, and just navigating again these different worlds and systems. It's you're finding these places of belonging, and you're in Iceland and realize, I don't belong here in the way that maybe is traditional belonging, right? Like of feeling like you're one of them and feeling like you're welcomed. Tell me about that. What did that do to you? What did Iceland do to you in your identity? Did it make you stand more firm in, I'm different?
Yes.
Period.
Yes, it did. Yes. Right. And plus, you know, Caracas at the time was a very modern city. We had cell phones. Mm-hmm. Iceland didn't. Right. And New York, of course, has been a modern city for forever. When I moved to Iceland, I was studying at Fordham. I took three subways to get to school, and I would read the New York Times, the New York Post, and the Wall Street Journal on the way to school every day. When I moved to Iceland, I could read Sunday's New York Times. I could buy it on Wednesday. And that was my big splurge every week when it was available, was to buy the Sunday New York Times 3 days late and read it, devour it. Even the classifieds, because they only had two TV channels. The internet didn't exist. And this was my way of staying connected with culture and language, of knowing that I wasn't crazy. This was not the only way. When you live in an island nation, people believe this is the only way. And an island nation that has existed for 12 centuries in isolation in the middle of the North Atlantic has a very strong traditions, which weren't always flexible enough to accept who I was. So, and people have these ideas, right, brought on by media. So they thought because I was Catholic that I was going to have a dozen kids. Most Catholic women use birth control. Don't always use it successfully, but we do use birth control. And they thought because I was Venezuelan that I was, you know, from some native tribe or, you know, poor community. And I had to explain to them, like, no, actually. And yes, we have electricity and we have malls and escalators and we have designer goods. Like, they had a limited understanding of what Venezuelan was. But by then, I understood very clearly as an adult, having lived in multiple places, what it was and what it wasn't. And so I was able to help them understand, like, no, that's not what it's like. And here's what it's like. And I would say that 90% of the people that I met were very curious. So they would ask me, why are you here? What are you doing here? Where are you from? Or they would touch my hair to see if it was a wig. Because they couldn't, hair like this is not. The mannequins in Iceland at the time all had curly hair like me. But all the women have blonde hair or light brown hair. Because we always want what we can't have. Right? And so people thought I looked like Cher. I don't look like Cher. I wish I looked like Cher. No, I don't look like Cher. But to them, I looked like Cher. Because of the hair and the color, my coloring. And so I understood that when people were asking me, it was from a place of curiosity. And then there was a subsegment of people that truly believe that the Aryan race is better than others and that I was polluting their genetic pool. Like, I respect, that's their belief. I don't have to accept it. I don't have to believe it. And I don't have to talk to them. So I would just step away. Just walk away.
How long were you living in Iceland?
6 years.
And what did it do to you when you moved back? Did you move back to New York? Did you go to the Bay Area? Because as I know, that's where we met. So now I'm curious of that story. How did it happen?
My then husband was in medical school. And so he matched it for his residency at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. And while we were at Dartmouth for his education, I had graduated from the University of Iceland and I wanted to continue my education. And so I pursued a Master of Arts in Multicultural Studies at Dartmouth. At the time, I was the only Latina in my program. There was one other Latino. So when Alex and I got together, 100% of the Latinos in our program were together. And at the beginning, I always felt a great sense of pride of I made it. And I represent, and it took me about 3 weeks to realize, wait a minute, I am pretty fabulous, but I'm not so fabulous that I should be here alone. Why aren't there other people like me here? Where are they? And if you can get into Dartmouth, you can get into Yale and Princeton and Harvard, but it was the beginning of that recognition that there's systemic biases that are keeping people like me out. And I happened to get in because I'm a good student. And I don't even know that I checked off Hispanic in that checkbox, right? I'm married to a Scandinavian coming from Iceland. Like, who knows what I checked off at that point? But I recognized once I got in, one of these things is not like the others. And at first I celebrated it. And then I realized, what can I do about this? So I started working with the Latino student advisors, who was Alex, by the way, and connecting with Latino alumni and creating a greater sense of community so that we could see people who looked like us who had been there successfully before. And then I started as an alumna to interview applicants because I wanted applicants to see people who look or sound like them or have a cultural heritage similar to them who had been there and been successful so that they could have a sense of, I can belong, right? I'm not a square peg in a circle. I bring gifts and values that other people at this table don't have.
Period. Yes. I love that your story of feeling so many times that you didn't quite belong to now you're in this space where you're like, okay, I'm cool, I'm dope, I'm fabulous and all, but I know I'm not the only one. Yeah. And I love that you turned it over to creating community and creating the things that you wanted to see, inspiring the feeling that you wanted to feel, like you were now giving that to other people. And I always, always say that my North Star is to be what you wish you had when you were younger. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like that's what was happening in that time of your life, is that you had been in these three different spaces, Venezuela, counterculture shock, America, New York, Iceland, which is even crazy to think about that you lived there for 6 years. But you were in these three different spaces feeling like, you're so different. Do I belong? Yes, I'm Maria, I'm Venezuelan, I'm a badass, but I wish I had that sense of community, of feeling seen. And to feel seen is to feel validated, right? There's yes. power in being seen. And now you being in this position of, let me create the community I wish I had. What a story.
I also spent a lot of years with Alice hiding parts of me, right? So I was Marie Higuerí, not Maria Eugenia Higuerí, but Marie. Not even Maria, Marie, because people felt more comfortable. Even though it clearly said Maria in my paperwork, people would always call me Marie or Mary because they could not associate me with what their image of what a Maria should look like. So let that sink in for a second. And I didn't correct them because I knew they were talking to me, right? And I'm trying to adapt. And so instead of correcting people and trying to get them to say Maria Eugenia Higuerí, Maria Higuerí was born. Right? Wow. That is adapting. But it's also whitewashing.
Yeah.
And now I'm Maria
O'Halloran. Gentrifying your name.
Yes. But I walk in with my Latina card first and foremost and front and center. And I often hear, you don't look Mexican. And I laugh and I say, neither do you. I'm not Mexican. I'm 100% Venezuelan. I'm Latina, right? Or you don't look Latina. Or even from Latinos, you don't look Latina. And I'm like, you know, we come in every color. You know that white cousin of yours that looks like Thalia? That's me. I'm the white cousin. I am the white cousin. It doesn't mean that I don't have cousins who are also white, but that's just like we come in a variety of sizes and colors and packages. That's one of the beauties of our culture. And I think another cultural value that I've held on to steadfast and strong is a sense of familia y comunidad. So yes, everywhere I go, I have tried to create the framework for community to come together. And I did that in Iceland. I was a founding member of an immigrants association. I did that at Dartmouth. I did that at LinkedIn. Everywhere I go, I try to help build this sense of community and with a sense of to whom much is given, much is expected. So I'm not just holding the door open for the next generation. I am pulling you through, right? Earlier today, you got to meet my mentee, Samantha. She wasn't ready to apply to business school, and I more than encouraged her. I literally pushed her. She's brilliant. She got over $600,000 in scholarships to go to school. But she had some limiting beliefs that were holding her back. And so now that I've gone through that process, that I understand it, I try to help serve my community by telling them, you belong. You can be successful. Yeah. Here's people like you. Here are resources. And so I try to be a connector, connecting people and resources so that we can maximize our potential.
How you're here, you're in Dartmouth, you're creating this space. How did you start to navigate a different space of now you're going into corporate, you're going into these other different systems? It's a different level of you belong or trying to figure out belonging in that space. How did you start to navigate post academia and just life in a different way, corporate?
Gradually, and I think with a lot of blessings. So I graduated in 2001, and I had a job lined up with Morgan Stanley doing mortgages for Spanish speakers. September 11 happened and I hadn't yet moved, and I pulled the plug on that. I was not going to New York with my middle school age children. I stayed at Dartmouth and I helped to develop the Minority Alumni Relations Program. And then from there, I left and I did an MBA at Washington University in St. Louis. Go Bears! when I was there, there were 5 Latinos in my class. 5 Latinos. And I thought that was a big advancement, right? Going from 2 to 5, right? Well, in my other program, there was only the 2 of us. Like here, there was like 8 of us, 5 in my class. Yeah. We had almost doubled what the previous class was. And I got my education because I felt like I needed the tools and the knowledge in order to be successful in corporate America. And Microsoft recognized that. They made me an offer that I couldn't refuse, and I went to work for Microsoft straight out of MBA. At Microsoft, I was part of a team of 126 people in the central US, a 9-state region. Imagine like just the middle chunk of the country. There were 2 Latinos and 2 Black people on a team of 126. So again, I'm in a place where I'm the first, I was the only Latina. The other person was Latino. And I had already built up some tools, and Ola existed in Redmond. And so I reached out and I started to figure out how can I create community here in St. Louis. And St. Louis has a Latino population at the time that's 1%. And so I figured, okay, how else can we create community and help build the bridge and open the door? And that was with inner city population, most of which was African American. But I helped to establish a 7-day digital camp for inner city girls. So building that community isn't just within our Latino community, but also within like physically where I am, what's the community that I can help impact and propel forward? When I came to California almost 10 years ago, I had this strong desire to give back to the community. So I went to work for the Hispanic Foundation. So from tech to startup to then a nonprofit, back to nonprofit, right after academia in Dartmouth. And I crazy to earn a nonprofit salary in a place where you have to pay high tech rent. But it was such
talk about that.
But it was such a beautiful time. Because I got to work with families in East San Jose and in the Bay Area that were, like me, immigrants, right? And talent is equally distributed, but opportunity is not. So I saw myself not as a savior, because I'm not here to save anyone, but as a connector to connect talented people to opportunity, to help remove obstacles that might be in their way, internal or external. And so through this College Bound Readiness program, we were able to help 3,000 kids in 2 years apply and get into 4-year college with a 98% success rate. Right? So pretty astounding. Eventually, the high tech rent caught up with me and I felt like a fraud telling my high school students, go get the best paying job that you can get because you're worth it. And then come home and be like, oh my gosh, am I doing this? So I returned to high tech. I went to Apple and then I went to LinkedIn. But then I felt like I was missing that impact. And so after 2.5 amazing years with the LinkedIn life and LinkedIn family, I decided to leave. so that I could pursue something else. And I wasn't sure what that something else was, but that time at LinkedIn had allowed me to really build some financial stability, but also to think about what would it take to do something else, something different for a year. So last year I launched my own company. We haven't caught up on this, but yeah, it took a lot of courage and it took a lot of figuring out not even the simple stuff, like how do you start an LLC, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And here we are in January and I've got 3 customers and I make 75% of what I made at LinkedIn, right? So is this my future? I don't know, but for right now, it's scary and it's exciting and I'm going to give it a go and see what happens. Like if the right job comes along, will I go with it? Maybe, maybe not. But I'm being emprendedora like my abuela was, right? She had a store inside her house. She sold stuff just like these tías and vecinas that sell paletas or flan or homemade cake, except mine is digital marketing.
First of all, love and appreciate so much that you mentioned your abuela, because I think that entrepreneurship became the sexy term probably like in pandemic time. And I realized, wait, my family is full of entrepreneurs. Like, yes. And they did it before it was even sexy, because they did it maybe because of scarcity, but they also did it because they knew there was power in building something of your own. And I love that you're channeling that generational strength, because we talk a lot about generational trauma, but we forget mm-hmm. that there's so much generational gifts and beauty that we also inherit. And you're doing it. I think that entrepreneurial spirit vibe is just weaved within us innately as Latinos. That's what I say is one of our strengths, is we can build because we're creative or resourceful. It comes from our cultures, our communities, but we have this power to create. And so tell me about this company, tell the world about it, and how do we connect?
Yeah, look for me on LinkedIn. My website is still coming online, but if you search for Maria O apostrophe H-O, then this lovely face will pop up. And what I do is I help companies build their thought leadership on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is, of course, my favorite platform because I work there and I'm biased towards it. But when you look at the benefits, the average income on LinkedIn is over $100,000. And so the people who can afford my services are there. Let me just say that again. The people who can afford my services are there. I serve business to business and business to customer. So I also help individuals who want to elevate their brand on LinkedIn and position themselves as thought leaders. And it's all happened very organically. It's happened with a call from one of the people that I work with to do that summer camp in St. Louis. She reached out of the blue, right? So Do good and it comes around. She said, I've been following you for years. I love what you're doing at LinkedIn. Can you help us? And I said, I can't help you, but let's talk and I'll connect you with someone. And when we talked, we're having this conversation, I asked myself, why not? You did it for LinkedIn. Why can't you do it for yourself? What is holding you back? What was holding me back was that I hadn't realized that you've been doing it. You can just keep on doing it. Right. So there was this own limiting belief around what I thought it took to be an entrepreneur. And then another friend reached out and she and I had known each other from working in both high tech and the nonprofit world in the Bay Area. And she said, I've got an ed tech startup. We've got our Series A funding. We're looking for a consultant to help us grow our B2B business. Can you help us? Yes, I can do that. I've done college consulting, doing admissions interviews for Dartmouth for 23 years, and I do B2B digital marketing. I can totally help you. And then another customer, somebody that I know from Minnesota, reached out asking me for support doing some digital work. And so these three business opportunities arose from my relationships and people recognizing the value of what I do. I haven't really been very public about it. Like when I left LinkedIn, I made this beautiful post thanking everyone, but I didn't say, this is what I'm going to do, because I wasn't sure. I knew there was something and I didn't know what that something was. And part of that something was my health. So I had put on a lot of weight. My blood sugar was high. My blood pressure was high. I was getting solid D minus in everything that was health related, Odalis. And I know, como buena Latina, primero muerta que sencilla. Everything was nicely distributed and you put some red lipstick on and you look good, girl. But
that part.
But the truth was that medically, I was not taking good care of myself. And so I was averaging 5 hours of sleep. That's not sustainable. I had put on so much weight that I was borderline obese. That's not viable long term. I was eating very unhealthy foods that were making my blood sugar spike. And in the middle of the pandemic, I was diagnosed with heart disease. And so I decided when I left LinkedIn, one of my priorities was going to be changing my habits in order to impact my health. And since then, I've lost 45 pounds. There's a lot less of me to hug.
Wow.
My blood sugar is normalized. My blood pressure is normalized. My cholesterol is within normal range. Now, people tell me, oh my God, you look so skinny. No, this is what normal looks like. Like literally in the BMI thing, I'm in the middle of normal. But I had gotten so far skewed to one side that they were used to seeing me there. And what I like to tell people is, thank you, I feel healthy. Because it's not about whether you look good or bad or skinny, or how do you feel? How is your, what is this body telling you? And it was telling me, take care of me. You're not taking care of me. You're taking care of everybody else and you're not taking care of me. When I was in the hospital, I flatlined and I wrote an article about it on LinkedIn. This month is Heart Health Awareness Month. It's also Black History Month. And I want to share that the symptoms for heart disease for women are a little bit different than they are for men. Right. And so I'm advocating for women and for people of color to take better care of themselves, to take those small steps to improve your health and to work with your doctor, especially if you have heart disease in your family. I had an undiagnosed condition. Undiagnosed. Two pregnancies, medical exams every year, and it had never been caught. My heart would go too fast. And I always thought that I was acelerada. I was always in a rush. I had to get things done. Type A, blah, blah, blah. No, my dear. My heart would go too fast and that would create adrenaline. And that was that too fast feeling where I needed to get things done, like a little cartoon. And then I would crash and I'd be exhausted.
Oy, señor. How did you get diagnosed? Like, when did it happen? What did it do to you? And you do look healthy, by the way. Shout out to you. I noticed it the minute we popped on. pero esa misma sonrisa, o sea, que eso no ha cambiado. But
yeah.
Tell me about that moment of health, because health is so important.
Health is so important. And unfortunately for women in general, but Latinas in particular, we put everybody else first. We take the dog to the vet. We take the kids to the pediatrician. We make sure our husband gets to the doctor. Everybody gets like breakfast, lunch, dinner. Like everybody goes to sleep. We go to sleep late because we're doing the dishes. We get up early because we want to run the washing machine. We put our own health on the back burner. And the truth is that we are the glue and the backbone of our families. And if we weren't here, who would take care of your family? So for the good of our family, we need to put our health first. We need to put our health foremost. And what happened was that I started to, I was looking for curtains online. So I had just moved. I was trying to choose beige, gray. I don't know, Amazon, can't touch it. I can't tell. Is it pretty? Is it not pretty? So I decided to make a cup of tea. And when I got to the kettle 10 feet away, my Apple Watch started to buzz. And it said, you are in tachycardia. You've been in tachycardia for over 15 minutes. You must go to the emergency room now. So what do I do? I'm like, wow, whatever. I'm going to have a cup of tea. This, I don't know what this crazy watch. So I had a cup of tea and I grabbed the laundry and I took it upstairs and I started to fold the laundry and then I started to feel worse. So I laid down. 45 minutes later, I couldn't get up. So I had to call my husband on my cell phone and let him know that I needed help. And he came in and I couldn't even talk. And so I said, just can you walk me downstairs to the couch and I'll just sit there and this will pass. Here we are an hour later and I'm still ignoring the watch is telling you go to the emergency room. So I'm sitting there 2 hours and a half since the first announcement from the watch. My daughter walks in and she's a medical doctor. And she said to me, Mom, you don't look good. And I said, honey, I don't feel well, but it'll pass. Can you get me another cup of tea? And she said, what do you feel? And I told her, my heart is racing. This says it's 250 beats per minute, but it's got to be wrong. So my normal heart rate is 66. That's normal. My heart rate was 250. It's like if I were running a marathon. I am not a marathon runner. Okay. So...
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. In her doctor's voice, she said, you need to go to the ER right now. And what did I say? I know, mija. Just get me a cup of tea. And she said, no, mommy. Dan can drive you or I can drive you, but you have to go right now. When I got to the hospital and then the nurse didn't believe me and she took my pulse and she immediately called the code. So what happened then was a wheelchair came out to get me. There were three attendings. I was immediately wheeled into the biggest bay in the ER because they expected me to have a heart attack or a stroke any second. And they made something called vagal maneuvers to try to force my heart to calm down, but it wouldn't. The vagal maneuvers failed, and we tried like five or six different things. And the doctor said, I'm really sorry, but the next step is to give you a medication called adenosine. And I said, okay, well, let's do it. And he said, no, you have to understand that's going to stop your heart. And so I sat there listening to the beep, 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 beep from the heart monitor. And I said to him, okay, but option A is I don't take anything and I'm likely to have a heart attack or a stroke or an embolism. And that's going to be painful and cause major changes to the rest of my life. Option B is you give me a shot of this thing and my heart will stop and then you will restart it. And he said, no, it'll restart on its own. And I said, and then it'll restart on its own and I won't have a heart attack or a stroke or an embolism. He said, you might still, but you definitely will if you don't have. I'm like, okay, so option B, give me the medication. He said, I need you to verbally say that you understand it will stop your heart.
Oh my God, Maria.
Oh, that wow. Is. Do you wow. know what I was thinking about as he's telling me this? Because this is where the Latina crianza comes in. I'm slowly pulling the sheets over my naked breast because I was embarrassed that there's 12 people in the room with me. And I'm sitting there in the broad open with everybody God. And naked.
Girl, if you couldn't wear shorts, you for sure can't be doing that.
No, for sure, no. This is what, like, el niña, ten pudor. This is what's going through my head. Niña, ten pudor, súbete esa sábana.
Wow. And, well, not just that, Maria. You are literally, you've been there for 2 hours, right? At that point, just with your Apple Watch saying, girl, you got to go.
Yeah,
and you're just trying to solve the problem. Give me tea. I'll lay here on the couch. It's okay. Yes. Don't worry about me. Even in the hospital. Oh, so what are my options? You're like just superwoman while you're going through this physical thing.
Yes. And I think all of us Latinas do this, right? Before we go off to have a baby, we get our hair done, we get our nails done, we do all the laundry in the house, the sheets are changed, the towels are clean, the guest room is ready for the people that are going to come over to meet the baby. We put a lot of thought into all of those other things, but we're not thinking about our health in the day-to-day decisions that we make. So I wound up having surgery, and the explanation is kind of like this. A lot of people know about heart disease in terms of like plaque in your cardiovascular system, right? That'll give you a heart attack. That's like plumbing issues with your heart. What I had was an electrical issue. So think of a lamp that has a short circuit. I was caught in a short circuit where the top of my heart was beating faster and the bottom was trying to catch up. And so they kept beating faster and faster and faster and faster. And that was as fast as it could beat. It was 250 beats per minute. So when they stopped it, I flatlined for 9 seconds. And here I am like worried about my, like pulling up that sheet. Porque por Dios, ten pudor, niña. And then it started to beat again at about 120. So still double what it should have been, but half of what it was before. And so the doctor said, okay, now I said, okay, good. Can I go home now? Like I wanted out. I did not like being there. And they were wonderful, wonderful to me. And I am so lucky and privileged to have health insurance, to have access to a hospital, to have top-notch medical care available to me. Right? I am very, very blessed, but I didn't want to be there. I wanted to go home. I wanted to get away from all of that. I wanted it to stop. And he said, no, we need to keep you in the hospital to make sure you didn't have a heart attack already. And we won't know for 3 to 6 hours. We'll have to run some blood tests that'll give us indication. And I didn't. So long story short, I survived. I didn't, but it was a catalyst for really asking myself, is this the way that you want to live your life? Is this the way that you want to treat this body that you were given, this temple that you get to live in? Can you make different choices? And so I thought I could do it alone. I couldn't. I worked with a diet doctor, like super like German strict, excellent, because if you like scold me, I will like very quickly snap in line, right? Good girl wanting to please everyone. And as a result of the last 10 months of really putting an emphasis on my health, I have worked out consistently every single week. For 17 weeks, I worked out every day.
Wow.
17 weeks, I worked out every day. And that's what it took to lose the weight, to get back into a healthy space. Like I'm stronger. I'm not just, there isn't just less of me. There's more muscle than fat ratio. All of the blood values are back to normal and healthier than expected for my age. So I'm here to tell our listeners that there are changes that you can make in collaboration with your doctor to impact your health and your longevity, because your beautiful light is important to this world and to your family. You matter, and putting your health first matters.
Beautifully said, beautifully said. I also want to bold and highlight this themes that I'm seeing in your story that are so beautiful, because we talked about belonging and we're also talking about hiding, which came up twice already. Hiding, you know, like, no te enseñar eso, like, oh my gosh.
Yep.
But also hiding, you mentioned during that time of your life being in Iceland, being in these different spaces, how you used to hide so much of yourself. And it's funny because I'm thinking right now about how often we want to belong, but how often we hide. And that prevents us from belonging.
This is true.
Most of the time. And so where do you find that middle ground of like, let me show up as me. Let me show up who I am as I am. And I may find spaces for belonging. And the way that I see you doing it, Maria, because I've interacted with you so many times, even at LinkedIn, you always had your lipstick on, always had your loud earrings. And when you spoke Spanish, you spoke it with just like all the pride in the world. And I feel like sometimes we have this authenticity crisis of like, we have to be super loud about being Latina because that's who we are. Like, I think authenticity needs to just be whoever you are. It means to just exist, right? And to exist without this expectation of I need to fit that Latina stereotype, or I need to talk a certain way so that they know I'm Latina. Like, just be yourself, just be mm-hmm. you. And I think when we hide, there's like, what would happen if we don't hide? What would happen if we show who we are? And I hear your story, Maria, and I hear the things that you've done at Dartmouth and the things you've done outside in LinkedIn, the things I've seen you done. You have created those spaces for other people to show up and to belong.
I hope so. I work really hard at it, but I do want to say it isn't always safe to bring all of you to work or to different spaces, right? I think I probably brought like most of me ever at LinkedIn in you know, that corporate space. Obviously in my company, I show up 100% me. At LinkedIn, probably 85 to 90% of the real me could show, and then the rest had to hide because there's also other things, right? There's ageism and there's other factors that I didn't want held against me. I didn't want people to remember me as the woman with the red lipstick and the big curly hair or the big earrings, but rather for the impact of the work that I did. And I think I managed that and still wear the red lipstick or the pink lipstick or whatever color clothes I was wearing that day. But there are so many people in corporate settings that continue to hide or obfuscate a part of themselves because they don't want to be judged. And I respect everyone's decision to what are they comfortable bringing forth. That said, the other side of that coin is that every time that you hide part of you, you're spending energy to hide, but you're also continuing to perpetuate the myth that people are over 50 aren't valuable, right? Or that Latinas are just loud and don't have bright ideas or innovation, or they're just diversity hires, when in fact, we bring in a great deal of innovation because we have this multicultural understanding. And if we speak multiple languages, our brains are wired differently, literally wired differently. Mm-hmm. And so for those of you who feel like you are ready to bring more of you to work, go for it. Analyze the environment, make sure that it's safe.
Yeah.
And then go for it. Take small steps with courage and with knowledge that you have value, you have brilliance, you have light and innovation. And if you're in a space where you can't do that, this is probably a good time to ask yourself, what does a space look like where I can bring more of me or all of me forward? And how do I get there? How do I get there from here?
Yeah. Love that you mentioned that, because there is safety that needs to be involved, right? Like a environmental safety, spiritual safety, for you to bring all the things. And it's okay to have multiple versions of you too. And that's what I always say. There's things that I don't say in the workplace that I'm going to say at home. And there's things that I will maybe vice versa. Like, but I think the point is what you're saying is that you don't spend energy trying to hide so much. You just are, you just exist. Oh, I could talk to you forever, Maria. I want to ask you one last question and then we're going to go into our closing. But I asked you the question of what was the expectation placed on you? And you talked about in that order, I had to get an education, get married, have kids, perfect life. Your life didn't turn out in that way. Looking back now at your life and the way you've lived it, how would you describe it? How do you feel even thinking back to the way you decided to live your life and create your life?
You know, as a little girl, when I was six, I wanted to be a UN lawyer, a human rights lawyer. So my mom was a lawyer, and we knew about the UN, and I wanted to be a ballerina, right? So like both things. And I think I have done a good job at continuing to bring impact and making a difference in people's lives, even though I don't work for the UN and I'm not a lawyer. And I continue to at now bring more joy into my life, right? That ballerina part, the part of dancing and doing something that was joyful for me is a big part of my own health journey now. It's doing something joyful every day. Mm-hmm. I didn't have my college degree when I got married, and getting married at 18 is not something I recommend to anyone. Like, turned out well for me, but it could have been catastrophic. And having two kids by the time I was 21, that's a big burden to carry while you're trying to go to school. And so it was a lot more difficult to make a life when I had to prioritize what was best for my children at all times, including not moving to New York after September 11, because I wanted them to be in a safe environment, right? But that's, I had the privilege of making that choice. Millions of people continued to live in New York after September 11. I just couldn't make that. I couldn't sacrifice their health and well-being, their physical safety, for the income I was going to get in the city. I don't think I have any regrets, but I think it was very difficult from a cross-cultural perspective when I got divorced. It was very difficult for my parents to accept. And a lot of people, a lot of Venezuelan or Latin families and friends asked me what I did wrong, why I couldn't keep my husband. Which was very interesting to me because I had been doing everything I needed to do. He just had different things that he wanted to do with his life. And now in retrospect, it was an enormous blessing in disguise. Right. I supported his career as a medical doctor and put my career and my education second to his and second to my children. So that's really third. When we got divorced, I had to get on that horse and get my education so I could get a job and raise my kids and move back to America. And I got a Master of Arts at an Ivy League school where I was the first of my kind in a program. And then I opened the doors to others. And that gave me the courage and the experience to go for an advanced degree in business and then work at a top 10 Fortune 10 company, right? And be again a first and only, and again, open doors and build community. Was it easy to get divorced? No. I also don't think marriage is easy, right? So I did the best with the situation that I was in. And I always encourage people when they ask me, like, oh, what place that you've lived in have you liked the most? I'm like, I've loved all of them. Do I love the traffic here in Silicon Valley? No. Do I love housing prices? No. But there are, those are not the things I focus on. While I'm here, I will focus on the good things of being here. Take advantage of where you are and make the best of it. And when you don't want it anymore, change. Move. You have ways of making it happen, what's holding you back. And so I've been able to make a lot of changes in my life. I lived in different states. I raised two wonderful daughters. Both of them are amazing humans. Along the way, I got the courage to remarry a wonderful man who's a school teacher. And I've maintained a good relationship with my ex-husband and his entire family. Right? Because familia is my top value. And when he and I got divorced, his family and I did not get divorced. And that matters to me, right? I didn't want my children to lose half of their heritage because things didn't work out for the adults in the room. Have I had a lot of learnings and difficult lessons? Yes. But each one of those brought me to where I am today. Have I been reticent to learn some of those lessons and God had to like put them out in front of me again? Yes. And one of the lessons that I had to learn was I'm not here to fix things for everybody. If you want my help, I'm here and ready. If you don't want my help, buena suerte. I had to learn to let go, like to let go of that need to help others. Tell me, buena suerte.
Ay, Maria, you are, again, I could talk to you forever. And I know you've been so generous with your time. I want to close this beautiful conversation with the brindis. I am drinking water because I've been drinking way too much coffee. But I don't even know. I heard it's bad luck to do brindis with water. No.
Maybe I'm going to say it's a healthy thing and we got to get past that.
I love it. You know, and I was just thinking about this whole conversation and how there's so many things. And you obviously, I didn't ask these questions, but you talked about things that you're taking from the culture and things that you're unlearning, whether mm-hmm. it's expectations, what a woman is supposed to look like, feel like. And I love that you are just owning this and you are so open, encouraging, and you have so much conviction in create the life that you want to create. Because I think in a Latino household, man, those rules, the lists are long. The lists are long. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's so many rules and you can't remember them all. And you're supposed to be like this. You're supposed to do that. You're supposed to do that. Like, there's so many different things that, especially as a Latina woman, because I can't speak from a male experience, but as a Latina woman, it is so difficult sometimes to be the one that's la educada, la enfocada, cuando te casas, cocinar, limpiar. Esto, the list is just endless. The expectations are endless. And the way that you have just told us your story in a way that you are so rooted in the way you wanted to live it. You want to get married at 18 and move to a whole different country? Let's do it.
I will say, for those of you out there who are listening, who've got this like drive for something that's a little bit crazy, like getting 18 and marrying and moving to another country, do a little analysis, right? But then if you still decide that's what you want to do, go for it. You've already gotten here. If you go for it and it wasn't the right thing, you just discovered one way not to do it. Now you can find a different way, right? It took Edison 1,000 tries to invent the light bulb. Steve Jobs did not invent Apple computers the first time. There were learning experiences along the way that helped to shape, right? Those failures were really learning experiences. And one of the things that I'd love to help your audience to hear is like, failure is a learning experience. It's not a final destination. You take that and you move on, right? So when I left LinkedIn, people asked me if I was crazy and I said, no. If I got here once, I'm pretty sure I can get here again. Right. It might not be today. It might not be tomorrow. But if I need to come back, I will find a way back or I'll find a better place.
Yeah. Let's close this conversation with the brindis. And I'm excited for this one because I want to ask you, Maria, what do you want to cheers to and what do you want to manifest for our Latino community?
I want to cheer to you. A tu salud, a tu bienestar, for your health and your well-being, all of you listening to this. May 2024 be a year of wonderful adventures and living experiences that bring you closer to that next goal or past the goal. And that when you get to that goal, you discover yet another goal that you want to go for. Because life is short. You never know when you're going to find yourself in the ER with 250 beats per minute. So you might as well make the best of it while you've got it. A tu salud.
Cheers to that. Salud. Manifesting. Salud. Manifesting that we all have good health. And I think also, again, appreciate that you are mentioning health for Latina women. That's something that the older generations of Latinas, I always look at my mom, my tías, and I always am that girl that's like, enfócate en tu misma. You have to go eat right, mm-hmm. go exercise and show this temple, as you said, this temple that we have. Show it some love, give it some TLC because we only got one. We only got one.
Replacement parts are hard to come by. But making one choice, right? One small step. Take one less bite or don't have ice cream after dinner or take a walk, like take one small step today towards your health. And you know what that step is. Maybe the first step is go see a doctor. It's always good to have that partner in your health working with you along the way. And Yeah. It's been such an honor and a pleasure speaking with you, Odalis. You have
Thank you, Maria.
An amazing voice. It always brings me so much joy to hear you. And it fills Likewise. Me with incredible pride to know that today we got to share time and I'll get to reach your audience.
Yes. Thank you, Maria. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your story, your light, all of it. Thank you. Thank you. Y'all, all of Maria's contact information is in the show notes. Go connect with her, check her out, be her client, be her friends, her mentee, lo que sea. And I'm gonna see y'all next week for more cafecito and chisme. For all Hella Latino updates, follow Hella Latino Podcast on Instagram. You can also find me on LinkedIn, or you can check out my website, odalisjasmine.com, for more information. Y bueno, pues, con muchísimo amor, tu amiga hondureña. Abrazos.